Hello and welcome. This is D. Garrett Nadeau presenting one of a number of podcasts on behalf of the Lancashire Authors Association. Today's guest is Alison Chisholm. Welcome, Alison.
Thank you.
I'm glad you can be with us. We're going to talk a little bit today about poetry.
Yes.
Because I think that's your specialty and you've had a lot of experience writing poems and things. But first, perhaps a little bit about yourself. Can you tell us like where you were born and what your experience has been?
Certainly.
Likewise.
I do actually come from Lancashire in the days when Liverpool was part of Lancashire. It isn't anymore. But I was born in Liverpool in 1952 and as a small child moved to Southport, where I've spent most of my life ever since. Very ordinary, traditional upbringing, mum and dad, sister, and no particular emphasis on poetry in my childhood, apart from the fact that I was always quite good at poetry at school. So when we had to write an essay every weekend, and everybody in the class groaned if the teacher said, well, this week you're going to do a poem instead, I was the one who was cheering because I thought we had the easy part of the task if we were doing a poem.
Okay, that's interesting. So poetry, you would say, comes quite naturally to you, do you think?
I think it does. I always enjoyed poetry. I loved poems even before I could read. I had a collection of poetry which looked exciting on the page. And we were great readers of stories and readers of books at home. My mother would read bedtime stories, and if she read a poem, there was something extra special about it, because it said exactly the same as a short story or a novel would say, but it said it in so few words and in such intensity of language.
Right. Did you start reading poetry then when you were a child, or did you think it was that later on that you...
When I was 11, I started taking speech and drama lessons, and of course this involved a lot of poetry. So prior to that, it had only really been something I'd read at school. And all of a sudden, it became something much more important to me.
So the rain in Spain falls mainly on the plains. Was that sort of a thing, was it?
That sort of thing as well. But the nice thing about it was we did cover all different periods of poetry, all ages, all sorts of poets. And one of the things about poetry, which I think is so valuable to education, is the fact that a poem can be about absolutely anything.
Yes.
So you learn a tiny little nugget of truth about any subject under the sun.
Right. Do you think that poetry tends to be about sort of specific, sort of individually small, detailed items, or do you think it can cover broad subjects as well, or...?
I think probably some of the best poems are the ones that take a small item or a small nugget of truth and look at it and examine it in such detail that as you're reading it, you're inferring something much greater. You're picking up the whole truth, the big truth.
But also, for me, it's the originality as well. The perspective is always, if you read Sylvia Plath or any of those kinds of poets who write about nature, for example, when they're riding, you think, oh, she sees a sheep, but she doesn't see a sheep like we see it. And yet, when she describes the sheep that she sees, if I can say that without sort of stumbling over my words, the sheep that she sees, when you see that sheep, it's so originally sort of described. And I think that's what's so great about poetry.
Yes.
And so difficult as well.
Yes, indeed. And I think perhaps the greatest compliment you can be paid about a poem is if somebody reads it and says, I've never thought of it like that before.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what we all strive for, I guess, when we try to write poetry. When did you then start sort of really concentrating on doing it, say in more seriously perhaps than you had done it in school?
It had always been a hobby since I started studying speech and drama, and I married, I suppose, comparatively early. I married when I was 18. Mm. And so I had my first child when I was 20. And so I spent most of my 20s on child rearing and only working part-time, doing odd hours here and there. So I had plenty of time on my hands, and it seemed natural to gravitate to poetry. During those years, I wrote a lot of poems just for my own amusement, never thought of doing anything else with them. And it wasn't until the children had started school and I had to think about, am I going to go back and find a traditional career or not, that I started to think, well, maybe there could be something more in writing.
Right. What kind of poems did you write? Did you write poems about the children or about home life or about nature? Or what poems were you writing at that stage in your life?
All sorts of things, not particularly about the children. In fact, it took me a long time to write about my own family. It wasn't until my third collection was published that there were any poems in it at all about the family. It's very difficult for me to say. I think we all cover certain themes. We all write about love and death and bereavement, about the sea, about seasons, about the natural world, because these are concerns that are common to all of us.
Do you work really hard on crafting a poem, or does it just kind of come to you sort of in a few minutes that you just can write it? It suddenly comes to you and you write it very quickly, or do you spend a long time sort of sculpting it into exactly what you want, or is it a combination of those?
It's both and a combination. Very occasionally you get a poem that presents itself to you in its almost finished form. I don't know how or why that happens, but when it does, I am so grateful, because it doesn't often happen like that for me. More often than not, I would say it's a matter of sculpting and moulding the poem, starting with an idea, teasing it out in different directions, choosing how much to include, how much to omit, deciding whether it's going to be written in a particular set form or not. And quite often my poems start in one form, end up in a totally different pattern. I'm also a believer in putting work aside. I try to get a complete first draft down in one sitting. But after I've done that, I'll leave it for a while, not touch it, come back to it a couple of weeks later, and then start the real work. And that's in the redrafting, the revision, making sure that every word is exactly what I want it to be.
Right. Do you have a writing routine? Do you get up early in the mornings and write in the mornings, or all every day, or just when you feel moved to write? Or
I'd love to say I only write when I feel moved to write, but I'm much more likely to feel moved to write if I've got a commission. So, by next Tuesday, I have to have written a poem about the First World War for a performance that's being given, and I will do it, and I will have it ready for the day, for the time. I would love to be able to say I've been working on it and thinking about it for weeks. And I have to tell you, it's going to be written on the spot for that event. Yeah. So I am a deadline writer.
Right.
Now, having said that, I mostly write for deadlines. Just occasionally an idea presents itself to me that has to be written. I don't have a set routine in terms of times of day or anything like that. But I work lying on the floor on my stomach with a black biro. In an exercise book.
Okay, that's interesting to know. So it sounds to me like you're quite confident then to be able to do that. If somebody says, I want a poem by Tuesday, and you say, okay, and then Tuesday morning you get up and say, well, I better write that poem now because it's due today.
There's a little bit of writer's advice I was given years ago. If you're asked to do something, you say, yes, of course I will, and then you panic afterwards.
Right.
So I shall just bypass the panic as far as possible, but I will do it, and if it means that I haven't done it by Monday night and I've got to deliver it on Tuesday, I won't go to bed on Monday. I'll finish it then.
Okay, well, maybe we'll have time for a little bit of tune, because you've chosen some songs for us. And perhaps we'll start with Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon and Garfunkel.
Thank you.
Like a bridge over trouble. when you're on the street, when evening falls so hard, I will comfort you. I'll take your part. Oh, when darkness comes
Okay, that was Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon and Garfunkel. Alison, why in particular did you choose that song?
Because I love romantic, gentle songs, and because that was top of the pops when I got engaged.
Oh, wow, that's great. So it has a romantic sort of touch to it. And
it certainly does,
special meaning
yes.
to you.
Yes.
Brilliant. That's
May 1970.
Good. How did you get engaged? Can we ask, how did you meet Malcolm? And
We met backstage in a theatre.
Oh, wow, fantastic.
I was appearing in an Amdram show, and
yeah.
he was a stagehand, and I'd fallen over his feet once or twice where he was sitting.
That sounds incredibly romantic.
So it does sound romantic. And then I saw him in full light when he pushed a piece of set into position and it fell over. So the flat fell over, he was standing there, and I thought, he's rather nice, that bloke.
Sounds like a comedy of errors somewhere in there.
Very much a comedy of errors, yes.
Brilliant. That's so really great.
That was 1968 that we met.
Okay, great.
Got engaged in 1970.
Together.
So we've been together quite a while.
Yeah, good life,
of course,
then.
Because it was a teenage marriage, everybody says it won't last.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're 43
So you're still
so
waiting for it to fall apart,
We're still
are you?
Waiting for it to fall apart, yes.
Okay, great. So I understand, getting back to the poetry thing, You wrote some poetry. You're writing poetry, sort of, as you were raising the kids. But at
yes.
some point in time, you decided that obviously the confidence factor here. You decided you could teach poetry. You could sort of wanted to go into that. You wanted to do.
Yes.
You needed to do some studying first, I think, to get some qualifications.
Well, it was quite interesting, really, because I just sort of fell into it. I was already, because of my studies and the work that I had done, I was teaching speech training and public speaking at a local further education college. And they were extending the range of subjects on offer, and the principal asked me if there was anything else that I could teach.
Mm-hmm.
I had been attending Southport Writers Circle for a couple of years. I'd been to the Writers Summer School at Swanwick, and I'd heard people talk about teaching creative writing and found myself thinking, I'd like to have a go at that. So when the principal asked if there was anything else we could do, I told him with great confidence, I can do creative writing and crochet. And so I taught both of those for the next term.
Oh, great.
And the creative writing, I don't mind telling you that I sat up in bed every Wednesday night reading the next chapter in Teach Yourself Creative Writing and then delivered it the next day.
Yeah.
So I suppose there was some confidence in the delivery because of the public speaking training.
Yes.
But apart from that, I just winged it really and it seemed to work. A few years after I'd started doing that, about 3 or 4 years later, Southport Arts Centre decided that they were going to launch some courses and classes there. And the principal was looking for anything that was arts-based, really. And all he wanted was for you to go along with a suggestion, with a subject that you wanted to cover, and with notes for the first 6 weeks that you were going to teach. So I went armed with so many notes that in the 10 years that I worked for them, I didn't actually get to the end of the list because I'd written down everything I could think of and a lot more besides.
Well, that's great to have that extra.
So it was quite lucky. It worked well. But because I was already teaching creative writing already for Crosby Adult Education Centre, Formby, Southport College at that time. And so I decided, well, if I can do the poetry at the Arts Centre, why not do that in the more academic setting?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started putting together the syllabus for examinations. And so for the Merseyside Open College Network, I put together a lot of the tasks for those that people could actually take the certificates.
Right. Well, that's great. Just as a sidetrack, I will come back to that in a minute, but I know you mentioned the Southport Writers Circle.
Writers Circle, yes.
Yeah, that's joining that group, I think, has been significant in terms of your, as a stepping stone for you.
Massively so. If it hadn't been for that group, I wouldn't have done a fraction of the things that I have.
Yeah, I found that with writers groups too, because I belong to various writers groups. They are immensely helpful. I would recommend anybody to sort of have a go if they haven't belonged to a writers group. There are lots of them around. I mean, the northwest of England is incredible, I think, for the numbers of writers groups, the number of people writing. There must be tens of thousands of people who are writing all over the county.
So many and more people than you would think.
Yes. Oh, yes. There are lots of people having a go. And I think it's one of the members of our group finds it a very spiritual part of his life, really, that helps him in his daily life. Has nothing to do with necessarily getting published or becoming famous or any of that other stuff that people associate with writing and writers. See, sometimes I think people who don't write think it's all about making loads of money and becoming famous and all of that sort of thing. And really, it's not about that at all, is it?
Not at all. And it's a very cathartic thing to do.
It is, exactly, yeah.
I think there's something about writing that actually helps you to put things in order in your life.
Yeah. And you don't have to be great at it, do you? I mean, you can be a novice, you can be just starting out, you can be learning or maybe not learning or just doing it the way you want to do it, writing a diary or a journal or whatever it is you want to write that sort of, promotes your life. It can be almost meditative in a way, can't it?
Absolutely, yes. And of course, if you're doing that just for your own interest, particularly if you're writing a diary or if you're writing about your experiences, it's also of interest to the people who come after you, to the next generations
of
the family.
Of course it is, for your family.
So it's good to do it from that point of view. But as well as that, you're producing a document of social history.
Mm-hmm.
And that has its validity as well.
Yeah, of course. Especially now, because at the moment, there's a lot of stuff going on about World War I.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people are writing. I think you mentioned, or you're due to have done something by Tuesday. For a hamburger today, that sounds like a Popeye thing. that's fantastic. So how many books have you actually published now? Do you know how many you've books of poems. Can you remember the how many?
I'll have to think about it. We're looking at something like 12.
12.
The
wow.
reason I'm sounding so vague is because some of them have been more pamphlets than
right.
books.
Right. Okay.
But I've done books on other subjects yeah. as well, particularly yeah. textbooks about writing.
I think perhaps you've got a poem or two that you can of your own that you can that you're willing to read to us.
Certainly. I shall do it in the traditional format. And
okay,
give you the
serious
one first and then the silly one.
Okay, that sounds great.
Now, you were talking a few minutes ago about the education side of poetry. So I thought I ought to read this one to you. Oh, Captain, my Captain. I see her leaning on the desk. See the nylon jumper, tweed pencil skirt, almost sensible shoes. She never had to raise her voice. One gimlet glance said all. I held my breath as, term by term, she cast us, and I thrilled to Helena, Miranda, Rosalind, wrung my hands as Lady Macbeth, wielded daggers over Caesar. When she recited, poems came to life. My skates hissed to Wordsworth's prelude. I learned the weight of an albatross around my neck, choked before I fitted Owen's gas mask. I strained to read her cramped hieroglyphs, longing to discover praise for laboured homework, scoring once when I had to ask her to interpret spider scribbles. They said, illegible. She was our hero, nearly our friend, in days when teachers were remote. I never wavered in my worship of her, even when I was banned from Ing Lit for fear of holding back the class. I've only met her once since then. Chance brought us to adjacent hand basins in town's most stylish powder room. I longed to remind her who I was, tell her how she'd helped me to become a poet. I caught that glance in the mirror, heard in my head my 13-year voice chant, "Good morning, Miss O'Donoghue," and couldn't speak. I passed her a paper towel. Our hands didn't touch.
That's lovely. Very
and that,
nice.
That was my inspiration, and I said we ought to have a silly one after that.
Okay, we'll have the silly one.
So we'll have the silly one, and this one's called Thong Song. When you're 20, maybe 22, and lying on the beach, with a stomach like an ironing board and bottom like a peach, all tanned and bronzed and glowing, it's acceptable, well, just, to split the orbs with stringy thongs, that's if you really must. But beware that if you stand and walk or paddle in the sea, you'll chafe and itch in places where to scratch lacks dignity. However, when you're 20 stone or 22, and lying on the shore with a belly full of stretch marks and a butt that's rather more like a pair of watermelons full of dimpled cellulite than a peach, you should remember that it really isn't right to divide the mass of blubber with garrots like razor wire, leaving twin blancmanges wobbling while the thong is riding higher. When the time comes to remove it, the extraction is extreme, and you hate to have to touch it as you know just where it's been. So when you shop for swimwear, buy some shorts, eschew the thong. For both stylishness and comfort, it is absolutely wrong.
Yes, I think some poems can only be written by certain people. I don't think that's a poem that I could ever have written, the last one. I wouldn't have had the insight to write that.
It's not written from experience. It's actually written from seeing a lady who must have been 20 stone or 22
right, okay.
sporting one on the beach.
I think I've seen one or two of those in my life now and again. To get back to the first one, I lost track of the references, the literary references. Were there 20 or 30 or how many? Have you ever counted how many references that you made in that poem? Because there were quite a few.
There were a few, but not quite so many as that.
Okay.
We were so lucky because we learnt Shakespeare from
yes,
a
I got the Shakespeare references.
Taught us that, to be enthusiastic about Shakespeare and not to be afraid of it.
Yes.
Apart from that, I think that there weren't very many, actually. There was the Wordsworth reference about the skates.
Yeah.
And Coleridge with his albatross.
Yes.
And then Wilfred Owen with his Dulce et Decorum Est, okay, which had a profound effect.
So a few references there.
A few references, yeah. Yes.
Oh, that's good. It's always good to put references. I know, but that is one of the issues. Interestingly enough, I remember reading T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, which, when he wrote it, there were about 30 critics who said it was terrible, that it was a worthless poem and should never have been written. Of course, now it's become one of the greatest 20th century poems ever written. And some people complain about T.S. Eliot, and he acknowledged that he makes too many references and it's quite obscure, and that he'll use Chinese or Japanese or whatever he feels like using in the poem. And when somebody says, "I don't understand this, what should I do?" he says, "Well, go and look it up. Go and, you know, it's your responsibility to figure it out as a reader." And then there are other people who say, "Well, why should I have to do all that work?" How do you feel about that? Because obviously you've had some references in that first poem. Was your intention that people should go away and sort of figure out, you know, the Owen reference, the Coleridge, etc., 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 Shakespeare, or should it just be for people who know that already without having to go and look it up?
I believe that poetry is all about communication. If the poem doesn't communicate with the reader, it's not doing its job properly. You're quite right in saying there are some references in there, but I hope that people could read that poem without knowing the references, perhaps not even identifying the quote in the title, just so that they can gain something from the poem. If they're sufficiently interested to look something up, that's delightful.
Well, it could lead them in that direction.
It could lead them in that direction. If that happens, that's lovely, though it's not the primary objective. But what I hope is that they could read that poem and think, "I've experienced that. It was like that in my English class. I understand that." Mm. That's the main aim in my writing.
Yeah. It's interesting because I've done some studying of symbolism, for example, and there are two, I mean, this is perhaps an oversimplification, but there are two kinds of symbols. There are public symbols and private symbols. A public symbol is one that everyone would recognize, in a literary sense. So fish, for example, would represent Christ. So that's a known symbol. But other symbols that writers use in particular, they may use a particular image where you have to figure out what symbol that represents based on their tome of poetry that they're writing. Do you use symbolism in your poetry in that sense, or do you try to steer away from that?
I think there's a little there, but I hope that people can read and appreciate a poem even if they don't pick up on any of the symbols.
For what it is, just
they can
as
read
it is,
for what it is, and hopefully they can enjoy it for what it is, or it can give them something for what it is. If people pick up things, if they find extra layers, I am thrilled to bits. But it's not the primary objective. The primary objective is just to give them something that they will be able to take away from that poem. I believe that if you can look at a poem and come away from it thinking, "That's something that I haven't thought about," or "That's changed the way I would look at that subject," you're actually changing the world. I would love to think of that going on in people's minds, because if you are influenced by all the things that you see and the things that are around you, and if you are influenced by somebody's poem that changes your thinking, wow.
That's terrific. Fantastic. Okay, I think it's time to have another song now. Overture from The Marriage of Figaro, Mozart.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, that was the overture from The Marriage of Figaro by Mozart. Alison, why did you choose that in particular?
Quite simply because Mozart has all the best tunes.
He was fantastic, wasn't he?
Amazing.
He was a great musician and all that. Do you, speaking of music, and, I know you've mentioned to me sort of in the past that you're not necessarily a musical person, but obviously poetry there is a musical aspect in terms of the rhythm, in terms of the way, the flow of the lines.
Most definitely, yes. But I am much more sensitive to the spoken word than I am to music.
Right.
And there is the rhythm of conversation, the rhythm of poetry. And for me, the rhythms of poetry and the rhythms of speech are more interesting than the rhythms of music.
Would you say then that you have a strong vocabulary? Are you interested in words in terms of sort of a collection in your head of lots of different words? Do you like big words and complicated words and unusual words, do you think?
Oh, yes. Or? I don't often use them in my poems. I try to avoid anything that would send people screaming to a dictionary. But I have been known to define a poet as somebody who can't look up a word in a dictionary in less than 10 minutes because your eye immediately catches the next word to it and you have to look that one up. And then something else and something
going.
Else. Have to keep going. I love words. I love playing with words. I love doing cryptic crosswords and playing Scrabble, all sorts of different word games. I will spend an idle moment thinking up rhymes and not particularly thinking of any poem I'm going to write, but simply to play with language.
Right. Okay. Would you say that you start then with an idea or an object or a word when you're thinking about it? Or does this kind of concept come to you that, I'm going to write about a flask, or I'm going to write about an eagle, or I'm going to write about something that you've seen or some emotional event, perhaps? Or?
It can happen in any way. Sometimes I've heard something in the news or read about it in the paper. Sometimes it's just a piece of conversation, a fact, something that's gone on, a cause for celebration, a cause for pain. It could just be a single object. And I actually quite like being told what to do. So I enter quite a lot of American competitions because they stimulate you by giving you tasks that you have to do.
They say write a poem about this particular, hence the World War One you were talking about. You're going to have to write a poem about World War One. You didn't volunteer to do that. Somebody asked you to do that.
I was asked to do that.
Yes, but
the nice thing about that is because I have got the subject presented to me, all I have to do is think around it.
Do you always do poems on request? So our listeners can write in to you and say, can you write me a poem? My cousin's birthday is coming up and she's three. Can you write me a poem about my cousin's birthday?
Oh, yes, as long as they pay me.
Oh, yes, that's the key, is it? Yes, okay. No, that sounds great. So, where are you up to now? I mean, are you still doing some teaching? You're still.
I'm in a state of semi-retirement,
I think.
I still have one group of poets I work with on a regular basis, and they are good. They are seriously good poets.
You see them as a group here at the house.
I see them as a group. They come here. We meet in the room in which we're speaking today.
Like a writer's group, really.
It is, yes, but it's a little bit more highly charged than that.
Yeah.
Fairly intense. And they're all at a high level, which is really good. It's very stimulating and very exciting. Now, that's the only regular engagement I have, but I also travel around and do workshops and talks and courses and so on in different places.
Is that a closed group, the group that come here? I mean, could somebody join?
People can join it, but I would need to talk to them first.
And you'd need to check to see that they reached a certain standard in terms of their writing, etc.
Yes.
Yeah. I think I understand that. And then, sorry, go on. You were, the other things that you're doing as well.
Well, I am one of the poetry columnists on Writing magazine. I've been working for the magazine since, within the first year of its publication. And that's a source of tremendous interest for me. I'm in charge of their competitions for the most part. Some of them are done by other people.
Is that freelance or are you actually sort of paid a salary by them?
I work on a freelance basis. I'm paid a fee for each article that I write for them.
Right.
Depending on the length of the article and the nature of it, the fee's a little different.
Yeah. Yeah. And that involves writing about poetry and competitions and things.
Yes.
The competition entries come to you then on a regular basis?
And
you...
Well, the way the competitions work, it's all done in negotiation with the entire magazine because it deals with all aspects of creative writing. And I'm only in touch with the poetry ones, of course. So a plan is made about a year to 18 months in advance. We know exactly which competitions we're going to be running, why we're going to be running them. And then it's up to me to set the competition with an article giving people help and advice. And then after they've had the opportunity to write the poems, they are brought to me and I have to go through and pick out a winner, a second prize winner, and then also to find a short list of the next 12 entries that I think are the best. And then I write an article describing why the winners are the winners. And I hope that that's useful for people who are studying poetry.
Yeah. I've subscribed to Writers Magazine. So
it's
a good magazine, yeah. It's got lots of stuff in it.
It's a lovely magazine to work for, but you've got to work hard, of course.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Would you say that your poems tend to be on the shorter side? Do you tend to go for poems that are not too... I mean, I'm thinking of the Romantics and Byron and poems. You know, they used to write Childe Harold was like immense, you know, it just goes on forever, some of these poems in the past. Ballads and things like that don't seem to be written quite so much anymore, or am I wrong in that?
No, I think you're absolutely right, but I think it's because of the requirement of these, that people were looking for something that was more of almost a novella length, perhaps not the length of a full novel, but people were looking for something that was much lengthier. But I think we are looking for our entertainment in much smaller bites these days than the way it was read in the past. I mean, even going back 40 or 50 years, you would find, for example, women's magazines would have short stories of a few thousand words. Now they're looking for a 5-minute read. They're looking for 700 or 800 words in a lot of cases, because we're wanting entertainment to be much more speedily accessible.
What would you say about form? I mean, poetic form. My impression is, and this is, I'm going to be very naive now. I'm very sort of pedestrian, I suppose. But my impression is that in the past, poetry was more structured in the sense that I had to conform to certain line lengths, that rhyme schemes and all of that kind of seemed to be more prevalent in the past, whereas now we have this free verse and blank verse. I know blank verse is iambic pentameter, but I mean, there's this kind of like, I think from the 60s it seemed like this desire to be free when writing poetry, to write any kind of length of line and not to be restricted. Do you think there's room for both, or do you think there's this emphasis on this freedom?
I definitely think there's room for both. And I think that we're very lucky. Each generation of poets is more lucky than the one that went before, because we have everything that's been written in the past, every style, every form that we can write in and develop and move it forward. And we can create our own, and the next generation will have those to work on as well, so that as the generations go by, there's a much wider spectrum. Lots and lots of different forms, lots of different styles. People don't realise how many forms. One of my favourite books of forms of poetry, which was written long before the internet started to put forward a new idea for a poetry form every week, and that lists over 250 separate forms of poetry.
Wow. Yeah, that's quite a few.
I wrote a book last year of some of the familiar poetry forms and one or two slightly more unusual ones. But I've put over 50 forms in there that poets are practicing on a regular basis.
Do you have a favorite form yourself that you like to use? I think you said to me in the past that it's important that the form and the subject and the kind of emotive content, they all kind of work together.
I think that's very important. I think that the poem itself ought to tell you the form in which it should be written. If I'm going to write a poem in a set form, I'm most likely to write it as a sonnet or as a villanelle. I think I'll gravitate a little bit more towards the villanelle because I'm not very good at doing the last two lines of a sonnet. Right, I find them quite difficult, especially that rhyming in an Elizabethan couplet at the sonnet, end, where you're looking for a rhyming couplet.
Yeah.
I find that difficult. But then again, if it wasn't difficult, it wouldn't be worth doing. but I think this business about the free verse that you were talking about, there are various factors that come into that. And I think one of them, which is really important, is actually more of a social issue than a poetry one. And that is that from the time when people no longer had the problem of not being able to read, it wasn't so important to have poetry with rhyme and meter, because it's the rhyme and meter that make a poem memorable.
Mm.
If you're going to learn a poem, you'll learn it far more quickly if you're learning something that's got a regular beat to it and a regular pattern of rhyme. It prompts you all the way through. You can't go wrong with it. If you're learning something in free verse, it is very much more difficult. Now, if you think about it, looking back into history, looking back at the earliest days of poetry, of course, when it was passed from one person to the next, rather than being written down in the first place, it had to be exceptionally memorable. But even so, when writing wasn't universal and reading wasn't universal, it was important that you should be able to remember things, and therefore the poetry would have
the oral tradition,
the meter,
really.
The oral tradition.
Yeah, yeah.
Nowadays, when just about everybody can read and write, it is so simple to reference a poem. You simply pick up a book and look at it. You can press the keys on your computer.
You can
have it in front of you. And then you do not need to have to remember it. That, I think, is the reason why we had to wait until fairly recently in order to have free verse. But I do think you need to make a distinction between free verse and prose that's just been chopped up and put on separate lines, because free verse does actually have its own form, its own dynamics, its own pattern. It's just a freer pattern than the strict rhyme and meter that we're accustomed to.
Right, okay. Time for another tune, perhaps? The Sun Whose Rays from the Mikado, Gilbert and Sullivan. Okay, that was The Sun Whose Rays from the Mikado, Gilbert and Sullivan. Would you like to tell us, Alison, why you chose that one?
I could have chosen almost anything from Gilbert and Sullivan. My husband and I are great fans. We love going to shows and concerts. And the Mikado is just a bit of a favourite.
Okay. You like that one in particular. Yes. Right. Okay. We were talking about organizations that we belong to and how important they've been to you. And I think I mentioned that I belong to a number of writers' groups. And, of course, this podcast is being sort of supported by the Lancashire Authors Association.
Yes.
And I believe you're a patron of our association.
I was very proud to be invited to be a patron.
Excellent. That's great. Because they have a great history, this Lancashire Authors Association, going back to 1909. I mean, you know, and some significant
people.
Yes,
and members all over the world.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That what we're trying to encourage an increase in our membership, trying to get more people. That's one of the reasons we're doing this podcast, to get more people interested and to talk a little bit about writing so that people know that sort of we're there and that we're interested in supporting writers.
Yes.
Of all types. Would you, and you do some competition judging as well, I understand.
I have been fortunate enough to be invited by Lancashire authors
that's
to do
great.
Some adjudications
yeah,
for them.
Yeah, that's
I've
good.
I've been very proud of that, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. Would you say that the writers are pretty good that you get, that the entries are of a good standard?
Yes, indeed. It's very difficult because in any competition, you know that there's always going to be, forgive me, a certain amount of dross. There's
sure.
going to be some material people, that just doesn't reach a standard.
People who are still learning.
People who are still
say.
Learning, yes. Or sometimes people who really perhaps should be writing more for their own entertainment rather than for competitions. Generally, you feel that if people are starting out, competitions are perhaps not the best way forward.
Yeah.
It's probably better to practice the craft a little bit more on having work published rather than entering competitions, where the competition is very fierce. It's very difficult to win a competition. But the overall quality of the material that comes in from Lancashire authors is always very pleasing.
I'm going to ask you a tricky question now. How would you handle a student or a writer who just didn't seem to get it, who wasn't kind of, you know, on the same wavelength as yourself and just didn't seem to understand what blank verse was or what, you know, the kind of form expected or whatever.
As far as things like, if they don't understand blank verse, it's my fault because I haven't taught them properly and I will come at it from a different angle until they do understand it. But to be quite honest, you do find some people who don't have a particular flair for writing and don't necessarily want to take it forward. I've had this experience twice with people who are attending classes and obviously paying in order to do the classes. And quite honestly, I didn't think they were making any sort of headway at all. And on each occasion, they were a few years apart, on each occasion I took the student to one side and said, I don't want you to feel that you're going to make a career out of this, out of doing this as a living, because I don't feel as though your progress indicates that this is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And on each occasion, the person involved, it was a man in one case and a woman in the other, on each occasion I was told, but I'm just enjoying what I'm doing. At which point I could say honestly, you are the most welcome person in the group.
Right.
Because that was fine, as long as they didn't have any false...
So it's about the student's expectations.
It's about the student's expectation. Now, sometimes you get people who come along to courses and all they want to do is learn how to make money from their writing.
Yes.
Some of them do that. More of them don't. But if people have a false expectation or I feel their expectation is wrong, I would rather take them on one side and talk about it. Otherwise, I would feel I was cheating them.
In terms of, though, of making money, what role do you think luck has to do with it? Because it seems to me there's some great writers out there who just never seem to get the recognition that they perhaps deserve for one reason or another. Do you think that plays its part?
You have to realise that when it comes to writing, only a minority of people will get published. Only a minority of people will make any sort of money out of their writing.
Mm.
Luck comes into it to a very great extent. You can be in the right place in the right time as a writer, just as you can in any other walk of life. For most of us, writing is something that is its own reward. It's pleasurable. It's cathartic. It's a good thing to do. It makes you feel good. If, as a bonus, we get some recognition for it, that's fantastic. But I don't think you can ever go into it expecting the recognition. If it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, just be thankful for the other gifts it brings.
What would you advise somebody? I think, let's take a scenario here. Someone writes something and they think it's really good. They've written this thing and they think it's really good. And they can't seem to get anywhere with it. And then they get discouraged. How would you advise them other than just saying, well, keep going, keep at it. It'll eventually work out, when you know maybe deep down that maybe it won't ever work out, that they won't ever get the recognition that they feel they deserve.
I believe that it's good to be honest with people. You need to tell them, I don't think you're going to make it as a career path.
Even though you think you've written something pretty good.
Precisely, yes. I think people sometimes have to be told that. But again, I think that if people are enjoying what they're doing, the best advice is to keep doing it, but to keep a sort of pipeline of work going so that there is always something out and something being considered. But I always advise people, and I follow this advice myself, to keep reading. And I think that's the place where some people fall by the wayside.
Right.
Because people decide, right, I've read all my life, now I'm going to stop reading and become a writer. And as I'm sure you know, Dani, when you're writing, you really have to keep reading as well.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
You can't give up on the reading, because otherwise you're losing track of the things that your contemporaries are doing, of the way that other people are handling the craft that you're trying to master.
Although, I must admit that I did go through a phase, I hope I've been able to get past that now, where my inclination, my subconscious inclination, was to imitate. And so the difficulty is, if you're reading a particular author who has a strong style, say, for example, D.H. Lawrence, this is where I had a problem in the past. I'd read D.H. Lawrence, and then I could end up writing like D.H. Lawrence, and so I'd lose, my own voice would get lost. So I agree with you 100% that reading is very important, and I've done a lot too, and that you must kind of keep up with that. But I think that some writers would advise that You have a 6 month block of writing, say, and then you put that aside, and then you do your 6 months of reading. You don't read certain things at the same time as your writing, because your writing could stray into that kind of style.
That's very interesting, and I would suggest that that's something that's different advice for the prose writer and for the poet.
You don't think that applies to poetry? That's interesting.
It's an interesting question. I've had exactly the same experience you're talking about. I read a lot of Damon Runyon's short stories at one time and then found myself writing everything in the present tense.
Yes.
You do pick up on these little tricks and these points from other people's writing. But when you're writing poetry, I think it's because every poem starts with a clean piece of paper.
Right.
Now, if you think about it, the novelist is going to go back to the desk day after day after day and be working on the same piece of writing.
Yeah.
Now, the poet is going to turn the page over every day and start something fresh, something new. And I think when it comes to the revision stage, you do notice if you've written something that's too derivative.
Right.
And the astute poet at that stage will, well, I was going to say scrap it, probably not scrap it, but shelve it, come back to it later, have another look at it and say, is this too close to the poetry I've been reading or not? As I say, I think it's something that happens more naturally in poetry, the ability to steer away from imitating somebody's style.
Okay. Well, time for another tune then. Queen of the Night from the Magic Flute, Mozart.
Oh!
Right, that was Queen of the Night from the Magic Flute by Mozart. Alison, a particular reason for that one?
Just because I think it's probably the most challenging piece that was ever written for the soprano voice. I speak as somebody who has no singing ability or experience whatsoever, but I just think it's a stunning piece of music.
Do you know a soprano when you hear one?
Absolutely.
Okay, that's great. Alison, we were talking a little bit about luck and about choices and, you know, writing poetry. And is there any other particular topic that you'd like to talk about in terms of that? What's something that you're interested in now or working on now at the moment?
Well, there's something, as I'm getting older and older, something that I appreciate more now than perhaps I ever have in my life before, is the fact that poets are amongst the few people on this earth for whom getting old is a terrific advantage. Because the older you are, the more you've got to write about. I believe that all poetry comes out of a sort of mix-up, a mash-up, if you like, of imagination and experience. And you're adding so much more to the weight of experience that as you get older, you've got so much more to say. I think that's very stimulating. I think you can look back and go right back to your earliest days, your earliest memories, and produce a fantastic narrative poem that will evoke those for your own interest and for other people to be interested in. But also simply looking back at things that have happened to you recently in the past can be a therapeutic activity. Mm. Very helpful and very interesting.
So there's an autobiographical aspect to writing poetry.
I think this is something that's very valuable. Yeah. And I think we can forget that it's the autobiographical poems that quite often hold the essence of the message that we can put across.
Every individual has their own unique perspective, their
Absolutely.
Own vision of a teapot or an eagle or whatever it is they're writing about. They have their own viable sort of outlook on that or
Definitely.
Way of looking at it.
Definitely, and of course, every one of us has been molded by the experiences that we've gone through and the things
absolutely.
We've observed.
Yeah.
And as soon as you put those things together, you've got these great riches.
And it can make it relevant to all of us. I mean, so, I know that there's a kind of a school of autobiographical writing in terms of prose, where people tell their autobiographies. But the problem there is you almost have to be famous, or you have to, you know, be recognized, or you have to have had an interesting life. But poetry is kind of different in that really anybody can write an autobiographical poem, and it can be relevant and interesting to outsiders, not
Most
necessarily
definitely.
The family.
There's a very strong school of populist poetry, the poetry of the ordinary person,
if there
is such a thing as an ordinary person, which I'm inclined to think there isn't.
Can we blame Wordsworth for that? Lyrical ballads and sort of launching off and saying we can now write about subjects that are commonplace as opposed to something
Absolutely,
that has to be
yes.
Related.
Even Wordsworth's contemporaries, even other poets, looked down on him because of the nature
yes,
of the subjects
yes,
he was writing
yes,
about.
Yes, absolutely.
So Byron was pretty scathing about him.
Yes, but a significant breakthrough there for
Most
poets,
definitely.
For
yes.
poets forevermore,
yes.
really.
And the human experience is something that's always going to be fascinating to other humans.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Okay, well, just to finish up, say thank you very much, Alison. It's been a great interview, and I've really enjoyed talking to you, and I've learned a lot. And we'll finish off with a final tune. Do you want to tell us why you've chosen this one before we hear it?
Absolutely.
Do you hear the people sing?
It's rousing, it's revolutionary, and it's a wonderful song for those days when you feel at odds with the world.
So we're going to end on an up.
Yes.
Okay, thank you again, Alison.
Thank you.